Hi, good evening. I would like to first thank the organizer of ASA, in particular Bob, the chair of the annual conference, Randy, the executive director. Marty, I communicate every 2 hours the past few days, and also the Belmont faculty members that involved Pauline and others in this conference. It's an honor for me as a scientist and also as a Christian to be with you all. And I looked over the mission of the ASA organization, what it has done and what its mission is. I think it's such an important area today in the 21st century. For example, my church pastor, Pastor James, sitting here, one day in one of the Sunday sermons, he said that the number of priests that from the divinity school that going into the career of priesthood has been decreasing. And young people, especially young people in today's world, many of them are going away from God. And there are many reasons, but one of the reasons I think relevant to all of us here today is modern science and technology is transforming our lives every minute. With iPod, iPad, and the technology is transforming every aspect of existence today. It's overly powerful and dominating. It's almost as if faith, beliefs, is pushed to the sideways. And when a tough question comes, such as the question of stem cells, fetal tissues, if men and women of science who are Christians do not stand up, express our views, and then those young people will be convinced by the other side that the science is everything, there's no need to have faith and belief in the technological, scientific development of the world today. So I think the challenge that we face as Christian men and women of science is particularly daunting today. Because of the rapid pace that science and technology has transformed every aspect of our lives today, it becomes even more important and more difficult to keep faith relevant. And when there's a conflict, such as stem cell and fetal tissue research, that I think it is for us to stand up, express the view that what's God's intention and what is the solution, rather than, in my personal view, rather than shy away from the conflict, maintain a dogmatic view, kind of turn a blind eye to the fundamental transformation that science and technology has given us. We should not reject science. We should embrace science. But we need to find a way to embrace science in a way that sits well with our hearts and beliefs. So I think this challenge, particularly of keeping faith relevant and maintain its leading importance, not only in our own hearts and minds, but also in the vast majority of other people, many of them, who do not have strong faith beliefs, to know that Jesus Christ, faith, Christianity is still relevant at a time when iPod and iPad is changing every second of life. So my topic today is faith and science, friends or foes. Underneath your chair, there's this handout, so which basically my lecture notes today. So you don't have to make any notes there. Everything I talk about is in the handout. But I thought I would begin the process by sharing with you where I came from. So the title of my talk is Appreciating Opportunities in Life. That's the first half of my talk. And second is Faith and Science, Friends or Foes. I think it's important for us to have a good, well-grounded cultural roots, tradition, where our faith came from, why we believe in Jesus Christ, What is our life experience that shaped us that way? And I want to share a little bit about how I came to Christ and how I find myself to be the pathway of walking with Him. This is a picture of a Great Wall. You know, everybody knows the physical significance of Great Wall, which was the amazing structure built by the first emperor of China 2,000 years ago. And one of the few structures that are observable by spaceship shuttle in the sky, a few man-made structures visible on Earth. But few of us understand the mental significance of Great Wall. What does it mean? People, in this case people of China, will spend centuries to build a wall to wall itself in. What does it say about its people? And will help us, because I'm going to come to that, we have a China Bible Project, which is facing significant challenges. One of the challenges is people in China think things foreign are bad. The Chinese has suffered through 100 years of being invaded, being exploited, with Opium War and others. So this is a Great Wall. It's important to know its mental significance as well. This is a map of China. Forbidden City, built for one man, the emperor. I was born in 1960, grew up in a family of physicians. This is a picture taken when I went to college. My father, who was an internist, and he was prosecuted during the Cultural Revolution for writing books, intellectually curious. A crime that committed by many intellectuals during Cultural Revolution, in the views of communist government. My mother, on my right, she is an infectious disease specialist. My brother, all of them actually now live in the United States. Both my parents are retired from Stanford Medical School in California, and my brother is on the faculty at Northwestern Chicago. So I grew up in a family of intellectuals, and my parents always asked me to ask questions. Why? I remember my father said when I was very young, I saw workers digging the ground, making ditches. And I said, "Daddy, are they digging the earth?" And one time we were in the zoo, and we saw these chimpanzees and monkeys. And my father said, "You know, these chimpanzees, some time ago, have changed into like humans." And I said, "When would they change into humans?" The ones in the zoo. 1966. The communist government decided the best way to keep on governing is to destroy the future of its young people. I want you to think about what I just said. The best way to keep on governing is to keep people ignorant. The best way to keep people ignorant is to destroy the future of its young people. So they started the Cultural Revolution. Every single high school, junior high, senior high graduate were deported to the poorest part of the country and condemned a life of poverty and hard labor. If any of us dare to escape back to the city, they will be jailed or killed. Just think about it. If you were in school, you're one of the students during those times, you work hard, you're looking for a life of opportunity, then in your teenage years, your future abruptly cut short and denied of all opportunity for happiness. Deportation means being deported to the poorest part of the country and condemned to a life of poverty and earning $1 a month for the rest of your life. Cultural Revolution or Cultural Holocaust destroyed the future of 20 million people. I caught that in the mid-1970s. I was 15 years old. I was finishing junior high, I was a straight student, I thought I was going to be able to have a life looking for maybe becoming a doctor. But communist government descended in my parents' house and said, Ming, you graduate now, go. Deportation. It turns out that one of the ways to avoid deportation is to have a music talent. Because communist government still have propaganda troops. So they have, you know, singers and musicians. So if you have a music talent or dancing talent, you could actually get into the communist song and dance troupe, so be allowed to stay in the city and therefore avoid deportation. So my father came home one day and said, Ming, I've got something for you to do. You don't have to be despair, you don't have to give up. I said, what's that, Daddy? I said, learn this instrument called erhu, Chinese violin. I said, I don't want to learn, I have no interest. He said, no, you got to learn. You want to be poor for the rest of your life, earning $1 a month? I said, no, but I have no choice. He said, if you learn this instrument, you have a choice. So that turned out to be one way to avoid deportation by joining communist propaganda troops located in cities. So it was funny that during that time in China, there was some fund interest in music by tens of thousands of young people. Everybody started playing piano and violin, and everybody became interested in music. But we know it's to survive. I remember when I picked this instrument up, it's a simple instrument with two strings. The bow sits in between the two strings. And it has the soulful, melancholy sound. Very gentle. And I picked this instrument up, and the one piece I found that I played over and over again was a piece written by a blind artist named Abin. His photo is shown here. Abin wrote this piece called Two Springs Reflecting the Moon. It depicts the scene in the evening when you walk out, there is a pond, there's a lake, then you see the moon shining down, reflecting at the convergence of two streams of water. It's beautiful. But it is a beautiful piece not because it's the natural beauty that the piece was depicting, but because it was an imagined beauty. Because this artist, it was blind. He was imagining how beautiful it would have been if he could see. This is one of the most famous pieces in Chinese music repertoire. And at age 14, I picked up this piece, I found myself resonating with it. I was playing this piece day and night. You think about it, it's sad. At age 14, a young man, a woman, should be excited, looking forward for life or opportunities, and but yet, I was at the end of line. I know that either I get into make music school, if I couldn't, I would be deported. So I was resonating, my sad feeling was resonating with the sad feeling with this blind composer. Now years later, I know why. The shared feeling between the composer and me, because he could not see physically anything, he was blind. I could not see mentally any future in my life. But my plan to avoid deportation through music playing was recognized by the communist government. So they recognized many other youth all learning music. For that reason, they put a stop. So you couldn't learn music. Then I started learning dancing. Because you know, propaganda troops need dancers. And here I show pictures. In fact, in the middle is when I was learning dancing when I was at the age. And these are propaganda dances. Mao, Red Little Red Book dance. And if you don't, I mean, those Red Guards dances around, sometimes dance around even somebody like you, university professors, who were criticized, put on trial by these energetic red guards that were sent there by Chairman Long, the dictator. So you see a picture of one of the professors in the university were being put on trial. But learning dancing was not successful either, because communist government put an end to that as well. So I had to be deported. I was 16 years old, and I remember that at that time I gave up on erhu and dancing, and I was distraught and just so sad every day. My father came home and said, "Hey, Min, do you want to study medicine?" I said, "Yeah, but I can't become a doctor. I'm not allowed to go to school." He said, "Let me see what I can do." So my parents practically bribed all the university medical school professors. So they put me subversely into the classroom in the back room. So all the university professors would open one eye, close one, didn't see the youngster sitting in the corner. That's Professor Wang's son. So I was studying, all of a sudden put in school and studying medicine secretly with no prospect to become a doctor. I remember I asked my father, I said, "Daddy, why should I be studying?" He said, "You study there, you can hide out from the government. The government don't see you, they forgot, otherwise they deport you." So that's one reason. And second, he said, "You're going to learn some knowledge. Knowledge will be always useful." So I was a good son, I listened to my parents, and I also studied medicine. And it was so hard because I did not see the purpose of it. Couldn't become a doctor. Anyway. Then government discovered Professor Wang has his 16-year-old son hiding out in a medical school, illegally studying medicine. No. If they don't take me out, my parents will lose their own jobs. So I couldn't even study knowledge for the knowledge's sake. At the lowest time in my life, which was about when I was 16 and a half, I met a young man whose father was like Arthur Miller of China. He wrote plays, and one of the plays was called Xiao Dao Hui. And the government decided there was a play that trying to criticize government, so they killed his father. The young man was 2 years of my senior, and he found me very in despair and very unhappy every day. He said, "Min, can we do something together? Like my father, I can write, and maybe you can teach yourself music composition." So I learned music composition, worked with him, and we together created many songs. Many of the poems he wrote, I taught myself music composition and I composed for it. I still remember to this day, one of the songs we wrote together. Remember, these are two young men, 18 and 16, for no reason, because they were born in the wrong place at the wrong time, at the bottom of their lives, giving them all hope for life. The song that we wrote together, this week probably did about 50 different songs. One song was the Prisoner's Song. And I still remember the words he wrote. He said, "At the foot of the mountain, there's my hometown. There's no water, no sunlight." And I'm not a good singer, but I was singing the tune that I composed at age 16. The purpose of which is to let you show the mental status of a 16-year-old teenager who should be excited and happy and looking for life opportunities, being condemned at the bottom. So it goes this way. The tune that I, the music that I composed for his poem. Do re mi, re do re mi. Na si do si la mi. Na si do la mi. Re mi fa re mi. So the dictatorship, the communism, destroyed the dreams, the happiness of so many. 1976, the dictator died. And China realized what a tragic mistake it made upon itself by having destroyed the future of 20 million youth, having shut down colleges for 10 years. So they reopened all colleges, and one day my father came home and said, "Ming, I've got something else for you to do." I said, "Oh no, Daddy, no more. I am a good enough son, I did everything you want me to do, learning art of wolf, I have no interest in that, learning dancing, studying medicine, there was no process of becoming a doctor, and music composition, I never got anywhere." No, he said, "No, this time is different." He showed me a clip in the newspaper, 1976, dictator Chairman Mao died September 9th, that China newspaper in the corner said the college entrance examination, which had been shut down for 10 years, may be resumed. He said, "Me, you can come to college." And I said, "Wow, I thought I would never be able to." I was so excited, so happy. I said, "Daddy, I guess I finished ninth grade, so I guess I will go to ninth grade again or 10th grade." But then he said, "No. College entrance exam, you got to go to the 12th, jump 3 years ahead." I said, "Wait, when is the college entrance exam?" He said, "2 months." 3 years ahead in 2 months. I said, "You're crazy. I can't do that. I forgot everything I studied. In the last 2 or 3 years, when I should be in the senior high, I was playing Oracle, I was dancing, I was trying to do everything except what I should be doing, which is studying senior college. High school, but I forgot everything I studied to begin with, I had no chance. And furthermore, my dad said, not only you have to go to 12th grade, you try to get into college. Now that year was particularly difficult to get into college because there were 10 times more applicants. Their 10 years of background students all came back. They want to get, so 1977 was the hardest year to get into college. Only 1 or 2% of high school graduates of 12th grade will get into college. So here I was, I drop off after grade 9, have not studied for 2 or 3 years. Now I have to jump ahead 3 years, cover all the material in 2 months, and try to be placed in the top 1 or 2% of the 12th grade. So I was in a new distraught this time, and was not happier. I thought, I said, "Daddy, I couldn't do it." First of all, ladies and gentlemen, this is the point of my first part of my lecture. If you remember the title of the first part of the lecture, let me ask you a question there. Why would my father, who was very smart, my parents, they wanted me to do something so inhumane, uncalled cruelty, you know, for 16, 17 year old to study that hard in such a short period of time, such a demanding goal, rather than just let me just progress, you know, sequentially, you know, go to 10th and 9th, and 3 years later go to college. Why did he press me so hard, force me to jump ahead 3 years in 1977? The very inability of many of us to answer this question is the point of the first half of my talk here. Living in this country, we take freedom for granted. But my father did not. He grew up in that country, he knew. Freedom was granted this year, the student can go to college, college entry exam was reopened, but who is to say maybe next year the government, the dictatorship government, will shut down college again for another 10 years. So this year I either go to college or we might never be able to. So long story short, this is how he did. My parents did. I was just an obedient student, son listened to them. My parents actually went out and hired dozens of teachers. When each of them say, you know, the chemistry teacher would say, chemistry teacher, that I will provide medical care for you and your family members for life. In return, you come to my house to tutor my 16-year-old son. So all of a sudden, this teacher was descending my parents' house and looked, staring at me. I was really stressed out. And they drove me 18 hours a day. And I was lucky that I actually got into college. And, but I wanted to, this experience shaped my viewpoints towards life. I did not want to have anything to do with communist dictatorship. I want freedom. I want to come to America. So this is a photo of 1976, the once in a lifetime. Those photos were taken by the students those years. The communist government may shut down college entrance examination again. So when I was in college, I realized there was an opportunity, rare opportunity to come to America. Because there was going to be a lecture given by an American visiting professor. So I knew what I was going to do. I've got a little plan of coming to America. So the night before, I pulled out a textbook. I studied very hard, English. Next day, the professor, there was one of the few times I've seen a guy that tall, blue eyes and tall nose. I still remember his name, Professor James McNesby. I still remember his name. He went up podium with 700 Chinese students, and he gave a lecture. And none of us understood what he was talking about, because our English was very limited. But we were good students, we listened very quiet, as teachers taught us to be. So he was giving a lecture like this, and finally he finished, he said, any questions? And all those Chinese students very obedient and quiet. My hand was very high. So he goes, yes. And I asked him a question that I spent all night preparing. I want to impress him. I want him to help me to come to America. But I didn't realize something happened. Was not prepared for that. I was standing there asking this question to him because I practiced, rehearsed all night, a single question. But he did not understand what I was asking. So he started talking, it must be something like asking him to explain what the question was. And then I realized I spent all night practicing learning how to ask the question. I forgot how to listen for the possible answers. So I had no idea what he was talking about. So all I could do is keep on asking the same question over and over again. Make a fool of myself in front of 600 or 700 students. All sitting down looking at me, man, you're so weird. What are you talking about? So I keep on asking, and just because I have no idea what Professor McNesby was saying. Finally, he figured out my question. It turns out that I did pull out the English textbook to study all night the night before. But I happened to pull out a British English textbook. The way the question was phrased was in a British way. I even remember the question today. It says, what is the academic load of your school? Because I picked up a question to impress this university professor, isn't it? So in Great Britain, it turns out the academic load has a specific meaning, how many undergraduates are supposed to have in chemistry, physics, which is subject applying, to get a bachelor degree. But in America, academic load doesn't have that specific meaning. So he was not really impressed by my English, but he was impressed by one thing, my persistence. So before Professor McNesby got my question and he answered, I have no idea what he was saying, but I got to ask the question. So before he went off the podium, he goes, that student, I want to see him in America. So 1982, I borrowed $50 from him. I haven't returned it to him yet. Yes, I'm very grateful to him that I borrowed $50 from him and borrowed enough money from relatives, one way airplane ticket, landed in Washington, D.C., then National Airport. Come to America to study. I was fortunate enough to be enrolled at Harvard and MIT, and this is a picture I took as a graduate from Harvard and MIT at the time. And I thought, attending a good school like this, first of all, I was so happy. I was given the opportunity to study where I could not. I give this lecture to many students in elementary school and middle school on a regular basis. The title of the school is, The World is What You Make of It. In this country, the students just have to study, pull up your grade, opportunity open up for you. But in so many other parts of the world, students don't even have the freedom to study. such as the young lady almost killed by Taliban in Pakistan. So I was so grateful now I was allowed to study. So at Harvard MIT, as I was studying, I found that many things I thought that I could find answers for in science, that I found one interesting observation, very startling observation, that the more science I study, the more unknown questions I have. So I began to ask myself the question, is it possible there are bigger things and more fundamental answers to questions of lives beyond science? For example, human eye. Human eye, that if you look at all the ganglion cells arrangement, the neurons, the synapses, the retinal epithelial cells, if you allow these cells, just say these cells are going to randomly assort themselves out, it's going to take more than the lifetime of this earth, or the universe for that matter. It's a mathematical impossibility that such an orderly structure, its very orderliness is vital to its function, could have any chance to have formed randomly. Beyond human eye, the brain. The brain is even more complex structure, the visual interpretation. That neurologist told us that the number of neuronal synapses in one person's brain, the number of the neuronal synapses, is more than all the stars, the planets that human has ever discovered in the universe. Can you imagine such a complex structure? Its very orderliness, it's vital to its function, is everywhere, a little bit out of order, the whole thing got screwed up. Could it evolve randomly? Neuronal connections. Furthermore, beyond the eye, beyond human brain, the neuronal connection, the genes and DNA, we have 3 billion base pairs. Yes, Human Genome Project has sequenced human genome, but that's just 10,000 miles, just the first step. Just imagine you could walk in the library with all the books on the shelves and all GATCs, but in some sort of random order, and then you pick a book, you see all the GATCs, TATCs. It's going to take you a long, long time to understand the grammar, the language, and the genetic expression. So having the physical foundation discovered the gene sequence, the 3 billion base pair of GATCs, is just the first step. It's mind-boggling. For example, questions like this. We take for granted when we have a genetic mutation, we will have a human disease. You know, cystic fibrosis gene, the mutation can cause dysfunction of the whole human being. Mutation in the retinoblastoma gene can cause retinoblastoma growth. The gene in the colon cancer gene, breast cancer gene, BCA gene, can increase the chance of breast cancer already 300 times. But we take for granted, when you think about it, it's amazing. Gene is such a small structure. To say that a genetic mutation at a GATC level will cause ultimately the human as an organism, the human bodily function dysfunction, given such a vast difference in size, such a small gene, such a big human being, the body, it's almost as if you're saying that you sneeze, whole earth will shatter. The only way that genetic mutation, such a minute size mutation, can cause such a big organism, human body malfunction, is to have every level closely coupled. The gene mutation causing protein, dysfunctioning protein causing gene regulation, expression dysregulation, and going up. So to just think a one human being on this planet sneezes, the whole globe will shatter. And that's essentially what happened when someone had a genetic mutation, have a whole human disease in their life. There's no way such a close coupling would come randomly. brain interpretation. It's fascinating to think about how we can use our brain to understand the brain itself. How can we use the brain, that which is based on the thinking process, to understand the brain itself? So I was bothered by a question like that. Right at that time, I met a professor who saw in this young man from China, originally, and struggling, and not finding answers to life in science. So he took me out for lunch. And he said, because he knew that I respect him medically, so he has credibility in my heart. So he said, "Ming, what's that across the street?" I said, "That's a car." He said, "What's the difference between a car and a human brain?" Oh, I said, "Human brain is even more complicated." And he said, "Is it possible a random part of square metal was assembled itself to become a car?" I said, "Oh, no way." He said, "How about human brain?" He said, "You got a point." He recognized a huge void, a deficiency, in my view of the universe, of the world, and he jumped at the opportunity and brought faith. He took advantage of a situation that I could not find an answer in science where I thought I would be fine, and showed that perhaps the ultimate answers to many questions in our lives came from Christian faith. The work that I've done ever since then has been much inspired by faith. Whether it's research, whether it's charity, medical charity work, whether it's foundation work that we work with other doctors, the fundamental driving force, the fundamental reason behind all that is the view that I have been saved, I have been given the opportunity to study, and I want to do my part. I just showed you some example. Recent years of work, the 3D LASIK, that's the latest technology for LASIK surgery. We had the opportunity to perform the first one in the world, which is a digital technology. The difference between 3D and non-3D is the difference between digital camera and regular camera. These are the textbooks that I published in the LASIK and camera surgery and cornea fields. And these are surgeries I perform as a laser eye surgeon. Young patient, 18 to 60, 3D LASIK, get rid of glasses. 40 to 65, the one that as we get older, you know, your arms getting shorter. And we have the 3D fire young man surgery to get rid of your reading glasses. Then when you're older, cataract, we have laser cataract. We had the opportunity to introduce many new technologies. And also, I've been involved with foundation work. There's no question that this country, we are going through a financial crisis of healthcare. There's no question, as the world's most powerful country, we should not have 15% of population not served, not having health insurance. The question is, how can we find the answer? I, for one, having suffered through communism and socialism, I do not believe bigger government is the answer. I came to this country from a country that's no freedom and choice. I appreciate freedom and choice so much. And I think if we're going to solve the healthcare financial problem, we should not allow government to take advantage of that and enlarge its power. But how can we do it? We still have to fund resources to help the poor. There's no magic bullet. But I do feel that part of the solution could possibly come from doctors volunteering. Work. So 10 years ago, I got together with 30 eye doctors and said to them that maybe we can make a little dent in the healthcare financial crisis by each of us agreeing to donate a small portion of our work. So then we found a foundation. Basically, anybody who needs high-resolution surgery could not pay, and we found that they have evidence show financial neediness. We'll perform surgery free of charge. Today, the foundations have helped patients from over 40 states and 55 countries with all side-resolution surgery performed free of charge. This is the story of Kajal. The Our Foundation found her several years ago in Calcutta, India, in the train station. She was abandoned by her family because Kajal, when she was four, one night she was sleeping, her stepmother poured acid into her eyes, instantaneously blinded her in an attempt to make her into a blind child singer who would get more money from passersby. Kajal was blinded, and then they found that she had no talent for singing, so she was abandoned. Our foundation found Kajal in the train station near Calcutta, India, almost died from starvation. Many, many Nashvilleian families participated in the process bringing Kajal to Nashville, and we performed one major side restoration surgery, restored a limited degree of her sight so she could walk around. She became so happy. At our foundation's annual event, how would you call it, a ball, a gala, the purpose of which is to raise money to help people see on the ball. Eyeball. So in our foundation's event called the Eyeball, after the speeches, the band at the background on the photo on your right struck the music Tennessee Waltz, and you see this little young lady came on the floor and did a little waltz. And when she finished her dancing, that I gave her a microphone because she was dressing in the middle of the big ballroom in downtown Nashville with in front of 500 eyeball attendees. And so could you say something? Say something to the big uncle and aunties who all loves you so much. And Kajal took the microphone, you see the middle photo? She broke in a big smile. She had a little secret. In her own time after she came to this country a few months prior to that, Kajal got together with several children friends of hers, and Kajal learned to sing. Remember, she was abandoned because she couldn't sing after she was intentionally blinded. So at that moment, I thought she was going to say something in English, a language that she picked up a few months prior when she came to this country. Kajal took the microphone, broke in a big smile, and she sang a song to 500 eyeball attendees. The song that Kajal picked herself and sang at that moment in eyeball was Jesus Loves Me. And the dancing that I learned during Cultural Revolution in an attempt to escape deportation now become a hobby, the more than a hobby, it has helped our medical charity work because we use dancing as a way to attract people to come. And what is better way to illustrate the powerfulness, the essentialness, the indispensableness of vision than allowing yourself appreciating the elegance, the sublime beauty, the discipline of classical ballroom dancing. It's one of the most powerful ways of showing emotionally the importance of sight. So my dancing hobby became a hobby. Now it's become part of the charity work. The photograph here is my wife JJ, and we were dancing there. And the music instrument I learned during Cultural Revolution tried to escape deportation. When I reluctantly played, I did not see the purpose of playing. My sad feeling was resonating with this blind artist, this two spring reflecting moon, this piece. The sad, the instrument, the melancholy sound. Now, 30 years later, I picked up the instrument once again. But this time, I wanted to do it. I wanted to express my appreciation to America, to people here, appreciation to God to have given me the opportunity to study. So the instrument, Arwood became a Carlos and I created this band called Music for Sight. Instead of Music for Ears, Music for Sight. To bring awareness, the importance to the public about the importance of causes of sight restoration. I even ventured into East and West. I believe the world, future of the world is by picking the best from the East and best from the West, combine them. And not to say which one's better or worse, but to say both are good, both have something we all can learn. And this is the story of Dolly Parton, actually. I did her surgery, and one day she came in, she said, Dr. Wang, I came in today not for my eyes. I said, oh, what are you coming here for? She said, I came in here for music. I said, music? She said, I want to play music with you. I heard you play this little Chinese instrument. And here I was, you know, in front of this country music legend. I said, music with me? She said, yes. So she invited me to Blue Ocean Studio Music Room here. I never seen so many buttons in a big room, I'm just an amateur musician. And then so Dolly said, here's the song. So she sang and recorded and broadcasted. So we said, listen, it's an old country song about American Civil War, about a young lady who wants to go to the war front with her man. But at that time, women were not allowed. So it was such an agonizing departure. She wanted to go, he said no. It's called Cruel War. So after I heard this piece, and Dolly said, do you have your instrument? I said, yes. She got all sound engineers around me, said, okay, go and play. I said, give me the score. She said, I have my score. I said, okay, how about the score of the song, the part that you sang? She said, I don't have a score either. She's very talented, she just sang with her memory, I guess. So here I'm supposed to play an ancient Chinese instrument to accompany an American Western country song without a score. So I said, Dolly, you made it very challenging. So we sat down together, and there's another guy, Tom, who's going to be the transcriber, music transcriptionist. So we listened to her piece, and I played a little bit. We're trying to imagine, in front of Dolly and I, this invisible music in between us. Trying to imagine what would the ancient Chinese whose tune should be, the melody should be to accompany an American country west song called Civil War. It's one of the ultimate creative process of Eastern and Western. So we did it. By the end of the night, we composed, I played, we recorded, we're done. Today there's actually a Dolly CD out in the market, and there's a song that I play, or who'd accompany her. So it's such an interesting venture, and this is another point that is, I want to speak to my Christian brothers and sisters. Yes, we have strong faith. We are fortunate in very different life experience we have found our Savior. But at the same time, I also want to tell my Christian brothers and sisters, it is also important for us to be sensitive of others who may have different faith, religion. The power of faith is not in its power of imposition others to do the same, but power is in the power of demonstration through our own behavior. So I feel in today's world, this increasing complexity, you got 1.3 billion Christians, 1 billion Muslims, and 1 billion Confucius followers, 300 million Buddhists. It is important for us to show the strength of faith, not by imposing others to do what we want to do, but demonstrating through our own action the value of belief and trusting God. But at the same time, respect others. And I think it's such an important point that I feel the power of Christianity can be even further increased and further strengthened. It's like two boys in school. No matter how correct this boy is, if he's tall and strong, always bully others. Doesn't matter what the point he's trying to express, he will not be liked. So the way we interact with the rest of the world is important. It is through, should be through faith, through respect, through sensitivity, through tolerance, through being able to respect another the way he or she is, not necessarily the way he or she we want that person to be. Today, I work very hard all the time, eye surgery and all that. Sometimes, friends ask, me, why you work so hard? Having gone through cultural evolution, having gone through poverty and deprivation of freedom, have been given the opportunity by God to study by this wonderful country, America, having found the life's ultimate answer in faith. I want to work hard. And when people ask me why you work hard, I said, it's from the experience of once having not. Here I want to take a little break and introduce to you a book that I brought with me. This is a book from Dr. Rice Brooks, and it's called God Is Not Dead. And the reason I brought it up because my story, part of my story of my searching for faith and beliefs, was included in Dr. Rice Brooks' book here. And we have the opportunity and honor to have invited Dr. Rice Brooks with us today. And I'm going to ask him a question because he compiled here stories such as mine, but many, many others, Christian brothers and sisters, seeking Lord from different lives, from different perspectives, from different cultures, different countries. So I want to ask Pastor Rice a question. Pastor Rice, I'm going to give you the microphone. Why did you title this book, God Is Not Dead?
Well, first of all, I want to say for all of us that you really are a treasure to us, I mean, who you are to this city, and I think we should just... restored the sight. This eye was gone, but restored the sight of the other eye that was going blind. So those stories just now. Really, you know, most of you understand the historic philosophical debate about the existence of God, and what Nietzsche and others would have said, claiming God is dead. And so what we did was we wanted to put the evidence together. As being mentioned, three out of four, I'll give the specifics, three out of four young people will leave high school when they get to college. They will pretty much abandon their faith. So what we do, we not only have a church, my friend Pastor James here, but we're all over the world. Just got back from the Philippines. We maybe are close to 1,000 college campuses now. So we spend our time working with young people, giving them the reasons to believe. And there are reasons to believe. In writing this, just a quick story that I'm going to get back to you in this brief little intermission. I went down last year to the Global Atheist Convention. Richard Dawkins, others assembled in Melbourne. I figured if 3,500 atheists were coming together, that I needed to be there to hear what they were saying. And on the opening night of a three-day conference, you didn't get a philosopher, you didn't get a scientist, you didn't get anything like that, a medical doctor of any kind. You had four professional comedians. And the whole night was dedicated to ridicule, insult. And I came away realizing that basically, in many cases, it's insult instead of argument. But I was sitting here tonight thinking about this, and I thought, you know, Ming Wang and what you represent, there are five myths that just came to my mind listening to you that your life dispels, that the skeptical agenda tries to say. Number one is they say you're only a Christian because you're born in America. Your origins determine your faith. And here you were born in China, and just like the growth of Christianity around the world is not just in America, it's in places like it's growing in Iran, it's growing in Africa. 1900, the year 1900, Africa was 8% Christian. Today it's 50%. So origin. Number two, John Lennon sung "Imagine There's No Heaven," saying the world would be better without God. But if you live through a communist regime, it proved that when you take God out of the equation, it's even worse than anything that you can imagine. So the 20th century was the bloodiest century in all human history. When people try to build a society without God, so you disprove that. Number three, that the Christianity is a crutch. And yet in your country, China, people who have faith, really, instead of a crutch to get out of trouble, are willing to sacrifice their lives for their faith. Another myth is that There's no evidence for God. That's why we subtitle this book, Evidence for God. And yet you sat here tonight going through the complexity of the eye, the brain, DNA. During the book, I was in the home of a man named Francis Collins, who actually mapped the human genome, and he's a wonderful believer. And so it just dispels the myth that somehow people of faith have no evidence. And finally, the final myth that you dispelled was that somehow that if we have faith, then somehow that means it's a cop-out. It's called God in the gaps. That we just take the uncertainty of life and say, well, God must have done it. On the other hand, your faith has inspired you to fill in those blanks. You're not, to you, God is not just the answer to every question. You don't have to study, that's just writing God there. But every mystery of life, faith inspires you that God has an answer, that the universe is, as Einstein would say, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that the universe is comprehensible. So thank you again. Thank you for your dedication to God, for your great witness around the world to us, and the representation of Nashville. So we're proud to be your friend.
However, material wealth does not equate spiritual wealth. At a time when China is doing better economically, the communist ideology has fell to wayside. Nobody believes in communism anymore because communism has made people only poor, such as North Korea and Russia and China. So they don't believe the communist ideology. They are advancing their economic life, but all of us living needs to have physical and mental food. Cannot just live on the material wealth alone. So there's a spiritual vacuum, and people don't know what to go by. What's the moral, ethical principle? It's an unprecedented vacuum. Nobody can believe in communism ideology, but they have to believe in something. In fact, if you ask Chinese leaders today, you say, what is the biggest problem today? They will answer with one word, corruption. As evidence of lack of God. When someone no longer believes that someone else up there is watching his or her behavior, if no other human being sees it, that's an example of non-believer, that person is more likely to behave unethically. So, this is spiritual vacuum. And this is a picture of Great Wall of China, the Nine Dragon of China. And Christianity started in 1807 when English Protestant pastor initially introduced Protestant Christianity religion to China. Dragon is the symbol of power in Chinese culture. And there are 70, 80 million, which despite its number is only 5%. Even though Christians are still a minority in China, 5%, however, the power of truth can transcend the numbers. There are many phrases in the Bible that says that. Peking Opera. And these are various different Bibles translated. And Chinese culture is characterized by this sense of balance. To understand China, we have a Bible project going to China, we need to understand the people. So here there's a few critical differences between East and West. East emphasizes balance, West emphasizes extremes. Black and white. It's like Hollywood movie. There's no gray, either bad guy or good guy. There's no same good person. Life is not like that. Life is living gray. All of us has good attributes and bad attributes. So, East and West. East believing when you decide to do something, you look in the tradition of doing it. West believe whatever works now is whatever works. East believe that you're doing things more than just for your own sake. It also shows how well you present yourself in front of your community. West, I'm doing it because I want to do it. East have a lot of superstitions and certain thought processes may not be the most efficient to lend itself to modern economy. West is based on efficiency. East tends to look things underneath longer. Just like old man, Chinese have got 5,000 year history, it's like older man. More mature, more willing to think, and deeper thoughts. And West is emphasizing superficiality and instantaneity. Just like Hollywood movies, you got to get to the answer quicker, got to have action. Car chase. So those are very different attributes. East is more reserved, less outspoken, a little bit more melancholy. West is more optimistic, more open. So all these are different attributes we need to understand in order to interact with the East. Even though that most of the Chinese are not Christians, but today God's words are the more transcend cultural barriers. Terracotta, the soldiers, those clay soldier barriers, the first emperor of China. This is a photo of Chinese. Chinese government sanctioned Christianity very strict, very strict. And still come in this country, they're still prosecuting Christians. And those are some photos. This is a historical opportunity to bring the teaching of Jesus Christ to a quarter of human race. And we have a Bible project, direct translation from Hebrew to Chinese into modern Chinese that young people use today. And our project mainly consists of speaking like this, identify volunteers, and these volunteers will become pen pals, so that when the Chinese got a Bible, that the person will be able to communicate through emails with his or her Christian brother and sister here in the West. Because when you're surrounded by 95% non-believers, it's hard to believe. The environment is not supportive. And you may wonder, that emails, that's good, but do I know Chinese? No, you don't have to. The number of Chinese who can speak basic level English has surpassed the entire United States population. And that's another different topic showing the importance of learning from others. That should not be good for us. We need to learn. We need to learn from other cultures and countries, and the first step to learn is to learn the language. So that's our Chinese Bible project. And I want to show you a few photos of our recent trip, bring Bible to China. This is a church in Shanghai, my wife and I went. And four services throughout Sunday, and the whole congregation stood the entire time. And it was not legal, so it was illegal, so we had to shift positions from hotels to hotel. This is JJ and I among the crowd. And the pastor up in there is speaking, as it did, in this case, singing a hymn. And the church is called All Nation Mission Church. And there's the pastor in the middle. And this church actually was declared to be illegal by government, and the pastor went into hiding. Our church in Shanghai got shut down five times in the span of 10 years. And why? On average, 2 years we existed, because every time we got shut down, we had to shift to a new location. And the government is so bureaucratic, it took on average 2 years to find us. So the New Chinese Bible Project is a project to bring possibly the word of Jesus Christ to a quarter of human population. And here brings the second topic, faith and science, friends and foes. And before that, I want to give a plug to a local Chinese American activity called Dragon Boat Festival. We have several guests in Jason Island, Chenhua here. And the event is September 7th on Cumberland River. There will be Dragon Boat competition. And it's a festival to enhance cultural exchange and enhance collaborativity. Companies sponsor different Dragon Boats and compete. So not just in Boston, the culture diversity in Nashville too. Faith and science. Let me ask you a very tough question. At the beginning today, I said we have to keep ourselves relevant in the time that modern science and technology is transforming every aspect of life. So do we conduct stem cell and fetal tissue research, harming the fetus, to benefit the adults? Or do we not to conduct research that's stopping improving the quality of lives? You may say, God taught us life is sacred. We should not touch the baby for the sake of helping adults. But what if medicine has shown us, which is largely true, that some of the treatment for some of the major category of human disease, such as diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, may all possibly come from stem cell research and fetal tissue? What if it's your own mother your aunt, who suffered from Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, and you know the cure, the treatment may only possibly come from stem cell research. And what we think about the medical sciences advancements, improving the quality of life, to say no is to stop advancing. Are you still going to say no? What would you do? And I want to challenge every one of us to think. And I want you to take a position. Do you do stem cell fetal tissue research or no? Here I want to show you my personal 16-year journey in working with science and faith, trying to figure out what is it that we should do in a time of science and technology when we have faith at the same time. So I want to show you a video about this 16-year journey.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ming Wang, and I'm here to tell a story. And through the story, I want to ask one of the life's greatest questions. Are faith and science friends or foes? Sixteen years ago, we were conducting corneal wound healing research and found that in contrast to an adult eye, which scars after injury, resulting in the loss of sight, a fetus.
I want to acknowledge the artist who actually produced and shot this video, a remarkable young video artist named Nathan Copeland. Nathan, can you stand up, please? So, the experience showed that God does want us to do research, but He wants to do it in the right way. And He wants us to use the amnion membrane to help restore sight without touching any part of the baby. He loves us. He wants us to improve the quality of lives. But He wants to do it in the right way. And also, we have to be patient, persistent. Nobody says it's going to be easy. In fact, often the right thing is always more difficult. The story on your memory contact lens shows this is a story of patience, persistence, and faith. So today I have the opportunity to share with you my story growing up in China, suffering through poverty and deprivation of all opportunity at a young age, and coming to this country appreciating the opportunity to study. And in the process, in the learning, finding out that science does not provide all the answers to the world, and faith provides the ultimate. And it's a story of persistence, and patience, and faith. I want to conclude this by playing a song or two with my good friend, Carlos Enrique.
Thank you. play for you is ancient Chinese song. I want you to close your eyes. It's been a hard day, lots of activities. Just think about the music taking you back 5,000 years to the other side of the globe, ancient China. It's called Big River. It's taking the life of fishermen, getting up in the morning, put their boat into the water, sailing down the stream into horizon. So ladies and gentlemen, Big River.
Thank you.
classic guitar. I'm a Chinese American playing classical Chinese violin, our group, so logically we'll play for you an Italian song. So ladies and gentlemen, Italian song.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.